and welcome to the Old and In the Way podcast with Bob and Mark. Today, we're thrilled to have as our guest, Dennis McNally, author and the authorized historian for the Grateful Dead. Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Dennis. And Bob, do you want to begin with some questions?
Sure. Good morning, Dennis.
Morning.
I'd love you to start with telling our audience writing your dissertation about Jack Kerouac, and I believe also your first book led to you becoming the Grateful Dead historian.
As I was researching the Kerouac book for my doctoral dissertation, I became a deadhead. They're completely linked. The same guy that sort of gave me a shove and gave me a lot of help, because he gave me a place to stay in New York City. Which, when you're a broke graduate student, is gold. And he had suggested Kerouac because his letters were at Columbia, although other places as well. And he was a deadhead, and eventually I became one too. And I wanted to do this book about the Grateful Dead, but of course I had no connections. So anyway, after the Kerouac book came out, I sent a copy through the Grateful Dead fan post office box and to Jerry and to Hunter. And long story short, eventually I met Jerry and mentioned, oh so casually, the book. And I think I did a good job, but the point is that the book, Jack Kerouac was like Jerry's Bible. He was 16 years old. In 1958, he was taking art classes at the Art Institute, weekend classes. And as a matter of fact, his teacher was a very prominent person in the painting art scene in San Francisco, Wally Hedrick. Literally, they started talking about beat, and Wally said, "You guys are beat. You should go down to City Lights and get this book," which was then, like a bestseller, current. And this was 1958. And he did, and he adopted it as his life Bible, his code of what was important in life and how to live it. And so when he saw mine, he was like, and eventually he sent some guys, and they said, "Why don't you do us?" And I said, "Good idea." So I started working on that, and then eventually I became their publicist.
Wow. and obviously meant to be. One of the things we've had a couple of people, Steve Kaiser, Tony Saunders, and Mark Tarrant. And one of the things we've talked about is the rise of tribute bands, to the point in which there seem to be, more auditoriums being filled by tribute bands than any kind of new music. And probably the most prominent is tribute bands devoted to the Dead. On any given night in the Bay Area, you could probably see five or six Dead. We used to call them cover bands. I guess now they're tribute bands. Some of them, like JGB or something that had a connection to the members of the Dead, and some that are just tribute bands. So what do you think of this whole tribute band thing? Is it at the expense of new music? And to what do you attribute the fact that the Dead are sort of the most prominent of things that there are tribute bands of?
There are a lot of levels to that question. One is, no, I don't think it's at the expense of new music, because if there's good new music, people will want to hear it. It is true that the basic structure of the music industry is in disarray, because you can't sell CDs because people can get their music free. And it's a real conundrum. My basic theory about the Grateful, and by the way, somebody made a list, and there are 800 Grateful Dead cover bands in America. And so what happened was, of course, in 2015, the band celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead with five shows. I thought at the time, shows you what I know, but I thought that, eventually the Grateful Dead phenomenon and Deadhead phenomenon would sort of dwindle away because all things must pass, right? I was wrong. And what I concluded and have concluded is that, and see no signs that I was wrong, is that somewhere in there, not perhaps consciously, but somewhere in there, Deadheads concluded that their love was not for the band per se, but for the music. The music is a separate genre. It's essentially its own genre, the way the blues is or jazz or whatever. And it has obviously the other jam bands, Phish and so forth. That to some extent, who played the music was a matter of personal taste. Now, obviously, Dead and Company, which theoretically won't tour anymore, although I gather they're talking with the folks in Las Vegas about that new venue, the Sphere. They will, they're the big dog, and then Dark Star Orchestra and J-Rad, and there's a bunch more. The point is that it is true. Bruce Hornsby called many of the Grateful Dead songs hymns. That there is as much part of the psyche of a generation, and that generation is now about three generations deep, because seemingly nobody quits. Fans fall away, and obviously some do, but if you go to a Dead and Company show or any Grateful Dead show that isn't in a bar where you have to be 21, the age range is somewhere between 10 and 80, and it's universal. The point is that there is very little, there's so-called alt rock, but most of, as you say, most of what is selling tickets these days, in clubs and larger places, is either rap. In other words, it's not rock and roll, which is, okay. I mean, it doesn't have to be rock and roll, obviously, but it isn't. What's left of rock and roll is pretty much jam bands, and their variations, of which the Grateful Dead are the most prominent. And I think you can largely attribute that to the fact that Garcia and Hunter wrote some of the best songs in American folk music. Folk, not as in, acoustic guitars, but folk as in popular music that's not all that specifically designed to be commercial.
I had a thought, like Lennon and McCartney, Garcia and Hunter, that at some point here, another pairing of genius musical minds is I'm going to somehow surface in this new confused music industry, and just on the basis of their talent and their songs and their music will rise up through all this disarray. And just because the music, I think the Beatles were just, their music spoke for itself, as does the Dead. There's got to be somebody else out there. It seems like one of the few rock and roll bands right now are the Foo Fighters, but I think that something will come up throughout all this, and we'll hopefully be pleasantly surprised by another giant talent that's surfacing. But right now, it just seems kind of generic, and there's nobody who's really out there that huge or big anymore. Or maybe it's
Oh,
my age.
I agree. I mean,
Even though I like Taylor Swift,
well,
but.
no, I think you're right. Well, I was going to say, You have some, I mean, Taylor Swift is obviously a phenomenon, both of talent and of, reward
Yeah.
and interest in her talent. Obviously, it's not rock and roll. That's not a criticism. That's just, that's not what she does. The answer is yes. The interesting thing is there aren't 800 Beatle cover bands for the simple reason that what the Beatles did in terms of their sound in the studio, because you really, it's you can replicate it, but the point about the Grateful Dead is that it's improvisational music, and so every cover band sounds a little different, and that's why I talk about taste. I like that one, I don't like that one as much, and because it's improvisational, every show. Even if you tried to like Dark Star Orchestra, which to some extent attempts to replicate the Grateful Dead, every show is different, and which leads to wanting to go back. I mean, that was the initial impulse with the Grateful Dead. But yes, eventually there'll be another paradigm shift, I would imagine. In our lifetime, I don't know. I only can suggest one, and again, it's not rock and roll, although it almost transcends rock and roll in spots. The one talent that I've seen emerge in the last 20 years that's transcendently gifted is Billy Strings. And I might add that even he has this contingent to the Grateful Dead scene. He's played with members of the Grateful Dead. And in fact, I went to, the first live show I went to. A big, fairly sizable live show I went to after the pandemic was him in Oakland here in California, San Francisco, where I live. Brilliant music, none of which I'd ever heard before. And it's really tough to listen to an hour of music that is completely unfamiliar. And then in the middle of it, he throws in two Grateful Dead songs, which were just astonishingly good, but the whole show was that good, and he's done it, sort of on his own terms. Between you and me, I haven't the faintest notion of how well his records sell, because again, it's this the business, the pattern of the business is completely up in the air, but on sheer talent, we'll hear from him for a long time.
Silly question. How many Grateful Dead shows do you think you've attended? I'm sure you've lost count.
Well, not exactly. I roughly figured that before I became an employee, I had seen about 200.
Jeez.
And my friends tell me that who keep lists of such things tell me that I'm not allowed to count the ones I attended as an employee since I was being paid to be there. But the answer is that I was at roughly 900 as an employee. So that means I went to around
Whoa.
1100, which is roughly half of all of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Your reference to them being a genre of their own brought to mind the famous Bill Graham quote, they're not only the best at what they do, they're the only ones at what they do. Of course, now there are 800 of doing what they do. But they certainly created a genre. Mark, I wanted to give you a chance to ask about Dennis's book, since he's certainly written about more than just the dead.
Well, I was curious with researching the dead, were there any particular challenges or surprises you encountered during the research phase?
Oh, wow.
And I would imagine there are just a ton of surprises because the more you explore them, the more outrageous it gets at times.
Well, the surprises were all, the little surprises of somebody would connect me to somebody else, and like, oh, I can't find this guy. Oh, I have his phone number. And that was that was just the treasure hunt aspect of all research. I love researching a book. I mean, you know, there's no pressure. You're not writing. You're just poking around, and you know, so I found, oh, guys with and stuff like that. That was just, you know, was a lot of fun. The challenge was simply in just digging in. You know, I started research before home computers, and before the funniest part actually was that. I started in 1981 serious research, and I was doing a traditional thing where I had a 33 ring binders.
Wow.
Pages and pages of just about the show. And in 1984, I met this lady who we've now been married almost 40 years. And she was Susanna Millman was the first member of the Grateful Dead family. And I met her through Dick Latvala, who was the archivist. And Susanna had known Jerry now for like five or 6 years at that point. And that's why he walked her down the aisle when we got married. She was the first adopter of a computer. She had the first Mac. It was 128K. Okay. And she taught Jerry how to use it because you could do art on it. And he was like, that really turned him on. So she coached him on that. And then he went out and got the newest, you know, like 6 months later, the newest Mac, which was 256K. And so did I. She was mad that we had bigger computers than she did. There were just endless things like that followed. You know, Jerry once said that you know the concept of synchronicity. Well, shit, man, that's our lives. These things would just happen where people I would know would, you know, turn up, sharing stuff. I once was standing with a gaggle of deadheads who were my buddies. At a show, and I said, you know, this was after I started researching, I said, you know, one of the things I need, one of the things I would really love would be to have a tape of the original versions of the Grateful Dead cover tunes, the songs that they had covered. I think I ended up with 3 90-minute cassettes of, you know, all these originals. People just went, oh, I can do that. I've got those records. So, you know, there was stuff where other people, Or for instance, what deadheads know as Deadbase, which was this giant program listing all the songs and all the shows and the songs played at the shows and yada yada yada, and I had started that as a, you know, sort of this, as I said, the skeleton to the book would be, you know, listing the shows, and it just got more and more complicated. And then I found this guy reached out to me who was a computer programmer at Dartmouth named Michael Scott, and he was doing this on a computer, which was of course the only sensible way, and so I connected him with a couple of other people that I knew would be good on the project, and I said, you guys go do this, here, take my list, improve it, and you know, away they went. So, and that's the kind of synchronicity that I got on researching the Grateful Dead.
A question about Jerry. I was fortunate to meet him a couple of times. And the first time I met him, Kelly took me backstage in 77 for 3 nights they did at Winterland. We got there at like 4:30 in the afternoon. I don't think the show started till 8. And we went into the funky old dressing room that they had in back. I guess it was a locker room at one time. And it was just me, Kelly, Jerry, and Bill Graham. And what I picked up in the 2 or 3 hours of just hanging out with them before The Dead went on, Jerry would talk, but he would go into the stream of consciousness thing, and he could just keep going and going and going. And he just had this wonderful natural ability to go from one idea to something not related and just keep in this continuum. And I thought, just as a conversationalist, he was off the walls. He was just incredible. And to some degree, I used to work at a restaurant called The Trident, where Robin Williams trained me as a busboy. And
okay.
I see a similarity, because Robin was always stream of consciousness. And then I meet Jerry, and he's doing the same thing, but almost less funny, more intellectual, but he could connect ideas that seem unrelated and just would go off. And it was funny because the time there was like a joint going around, and Kelly was more into wine. Bill Graham didn't touch anything. So every time I passed the joint to Jerry, it was usually the last I saw of it, but he would just never stop talking and was hilarious. So I was wondering, I'm sure you've had many of those experiences.
If you, of those books, Jerry on Jerry is a two type book. It's a book, you know, words on paper. There's also an audio version. And it is a painful subject to me, because most deadheads don't realize that the audio book is like 7 hours of Jerry talking. Demonstrating just what you said. He was a brilliant conversationalist. He was a brilliant conversationalist because he listened as well as talked. He actually was in thought. It's one of the reasons why he was just a legendary interview. 99% of all rock and roll interviews are commercial pitches. You know, they're selling something. Jerry wasn't interested in that. He would do an interview and he wanted to talk to them. And he was fantastic at it. You know, it's as simple as that. He really wanted to communicate with people, which made for, you know, fascinating interviews. I will also add, by the way, that Kelly, who was one of my favorite, I miss him so much, one of my favorite people in the general scene, had the same
Kelly.
Kind of the same knack. Yeah.
He was a contrarian.
He loved to, you know, tell you were wrong. But you know, so smart. And so, I mean, Jerry was brilliant. He had that... It gets called charisma, because he had this knack for relating to people and for having people want to listen to him, whether it was music or talk, and, you know, sort of follow him around. That started when he was 18, and went until he died.
Wow. You've written so many other books. Is there anything you want to, speaking of being commercial, is there anything new you want to plug or any of the ones you'd like to talk up?
Yes, I will. I'll just, because I've just finished a book that's just gone to the editor. It'll be out probably in a year. It's called The Last Great Dream. And it's about the origins of the Haight-Ashbury. And the whole psychedelic 60s, but the origins, not just, most of the books about, you know, San Francisco and the Haight start in like 1965, as though it just sort of popped up, and their roots. And, you know, that's what historians do, is look at roots. It's kind of volume four of Dennis McNally, because the first one was The Grateful Dead, was Kerouac. So that's like the 1950s, the bohemia, the counterculture, whatever you want to call it, post-World War II. The second one was The Grateful Dead, which is the 60s. and the 70s, and you get the 80s and 90s because I was slow. The third book, which is called On Highway 61, is the backdrop, and it runs from Thoreau, and it's about American, again, American contrarians, to use the phrase, the people that would lead. Basically, it's about what white people got from black music. Thoreau didn't get it so much from black music as the black reality of slavery and his abolitionist work. But then it goes through Mark Twain and ragtime and all the way up to Kerouac, who was getting it from jazz, and then all the way up to Dylan. So that's volume three. And now volume four, which I suspect will be my last, is specifically about the hate. So yeah, The Last Great Dream, and in all your better bookstores sometime in the spring of 25.
Awesome. We've got about 7 minutes left because we're too cheap to pay for the premium level of Zoom. But I didn't want to not touch on in your background that piqued my interest, and I think would pique people's interest, is your involvement with the ACLU over many years and with the Zen Center.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about those. Why you your interest and why you support those things.
Well, I'm a practicing Zen Buddhist, and the really the one of the fundamental sources of Buddhism in America in the 21st century was the San Francisco Zen Center, and I've been part of that for I don't know, 15 years or so, more I guess now, and so I contributed as I could. I started. I was invited. When the Grateful Dead had the Rex, you know, and it still does, the Rex Foundation still exists, and I asked them to give money to the ACLU because, as far as I'm concerned, it is the fundamental defense of the Constitution and our freedom to speak in various ways. And eventually, they asked me to join the board. And literally, I went to my first board meeting like 2 days after Jerry died, and they were kind of surprised to see me. But I said, you know, I mean, the money that I've been able to bring in because of Grateful Dead, is that's not going to be there anymore. So do you really want me? And they said, yeah. So I stuck around and was good. All institutions develop clay, you know, feet of clay. Whether you work for the Grateful Dead and find out that, you know, everything isn't love and flowers always, and that they're human beings, and that matter. And, you know, some of the, you know, not so much bad stuff as dumb stuff still happens. But the fact is, ACLU has kept its skirts clean much better than almost any organization I can think of, and have done some wonderful work and some very noble work. I mean, they defended the right of Nazis to march on the principle that you shut down one person, you start down a slippery slope. And that was noble, and it cost them a lot. But, you know, that's the way it goes.
I've got a Grateful Dead question. Up in this corner here, the yes. American Beauty album jacket, I'm guessing you know the double meaning.
Yes, it can read as American reality, and that's, of course, I'm pretty sure that part specifically, well, I don't know whether Kelly did it or Mouse. Generally, Kelly was the idea guy and the sources, yeah, American reality.
I'm shocked how many deadheads don't have a clue.
No, it's, you know,
I spring that on people and they go, I've been listening to them for 40 years. Nobody told me.
Gotta ask.
Are you aware of the background story? Am I doing this right with the ice cream cone in the head?
Yeah, yes, I am, as a matter of fact. Actually, Kelly...
There's nothing I can tell you don't know.
Well, I've been around a while, and I was taking notes. Kelly actually gave my wife and I a artist proof of that cover for our wedding present, and it still hangs in our bedroom. It was the image of the great. They described it as the image of the Grateful Dead self-image when they went to Europe, that they were a bunch of doofus Americans. With this, that were slightly spastic, slightly inept, but good-hearted, and so came up with the idea of the ice cream kid is what they called him.
Can I share one more Kelly story?
Sure.
He had a two-story townhome in San Rafael off of Bay Street. You go down B, you hit Bay Street, and there was a condominium complex. And after work, I'd go over there multiple afternoons, and we got into Kelly would drink his wine. I'd smoke a couple of joints, have some beer, and we put on Pink Floyd's Animals, and his bird Studebaker would sing along beautifully with the album, knew when to come in, and the bird just killed it. And I cannot tell you how many times we listened to that damn album and damn bird, but it was killer each time. But one afternoon, Kelly says he's expecting a long distance phone call. And at this time, he had completed the Wings artwork with the bubble mirror. And then was working on a second Wings poster, and this is when the artists worked directly with the people doing their album jacket stuff or posters, whatever. So he goes upstairs to take a shit. The phone rings, and this guy goes, "Hi, this is Paul. It's Kelly there." And not thinking, Paul with a British accent. I say he's upstairs taking a shit as Kelly comes running down the stairs trying to pull his pants up to take the phone away from me, and he's saying, "What are you saying?" And he gets on the phone, and I guess McCartney's laughing his ass off,
Of course.
and they had a nice conversation. And then he goes, "Why the fuck did you say that?" I said, "Well, who was that?" He goes, "It's Paul McCartney." And I go, "Oh, you're just BSing me." And to this day, I don't know what's true or what's not, but
Oh,
it
what
was
a
an
bum.
interesting moment in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you a very rough and brief parallel, which was that I was with Mickey Hart and we were doing the Today Show. And the show starts shooting at 7. So if you're going to do a sound check, you have to be there at 6 a.m. And we changed. And one of the people in the band was Edie Brickell, who was married to Paul Simon. And we had to pick her up on the way to the sound check. And I had to call her home number to say, listen, it's going to be 5:30 instead of whatever, a change. And Paul Simon answers the phone. And I'm listening to this voice, which is so familiar, the voice. And he's going, why does she have to go so early? And I go, well, the show starts at 7, blah, blah, blah. And,